You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the world's bemused reaction to the news that Boris Johnson will be the UK's new Foreign Secretary. Is there some level beyond the comprehension of most mortals on which his appointment is in fact a work of subtle genius? My guests Isabel Hilton and Robert Fox will be here to discuss this proposition and the day's other big stories, including Britain's imminent vote on whether or not to remain a nuclear-armed superpower, Donald Trump's even more imminent announcement of a vice presidential running mate, and the South China Sea again. Is there anyone or anything which can stop China doing as it pleases? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests, in fact, today are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and Robert Fox, defence editor of the Evening Standard. Welcome both. And we will start right here in London, where, as we speak, the language courses offered to diplomats at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office are being updated to include the phrases "what he meant to say was" and "no offence was intended." The appointment of Boris Johnson to the role of Foreign Secretary by incoming Prime Minister Theresa May has prompted widespread bemusement, not least among Britain's allies, which may now have to be reclassified as enemies Britain has not yet made. France's Foreign Minister Jean-Marc Ayrault has already dismissed Johnson as a liar, and his German counterpart Frank-Walter Steinmeier described him as ungehörig. Apologies for the pronunciation, but I like German words, even if I can't say them. It translates broadly as monstrous. Isabel, we've had about a day to get used to this idea now. Is it as weird as it initially seemed?
I think it's going to take me a lot longer than a day, honestly. And, you know, I'm reminded of there was a senior British civil servant whose job he described as, in the Thatcher era, as going around dispensing brandy and aspirin to people who just met the Prime Minister. And I think there'll be a whole department in the Foreign Office of this nature. It strikes me as perverse. There was Boris, you know, in the middle of the wreckage of his career, a wreckage that he'd created.
Indeed.
Why would you fish him out? And look, there are a number of possible reasons. Perhaps Theresa May felt Britain had not been sufficiently humiliated. Perhaps she thinks the rest of the world doesn't matter. Perhaps she thinks that foreign policy no longer resides in the Foreign Office, which is possible. And perhaps she is out to punish the Brexiteers for all the lies and false promises that they made during the campaign by making them responsible for the policy. Because this government is bound to fail in what it's set out to do, which is to satisfy everybody who voted for to leave the European Union. Because the one thing we know is that we don't know what they want, and they all want different things. So, you know, by definition, it's bound to fail. And she's distributing the blame in advance. I suspect it's the only plausible strategy, and it speaks to a government that once again is putting Conservative Party interests way ahead of the country.
Robert, what do you think? There is there was an instant and indeed gathering assumption that Theresa May must be up to something in appointing Boris Johnson's Foreign Secretary. Whether she's setting him up to fail on the assumption that on his first official engagement he'll say or do something ghastly so she can sack him and punt him back off to the backbenches saying, "Well, I tried." Does she just have to give one of the top jobs to a Brexiteer? Here, so she gives the one that she's not really all that bothered about to the one who wasn't the most adamantine Brexiteer campaigner. What do you think's going on?
I think there's something very personal going on, and I think it's about her own personal survival. And I think she wanted him inside the tent because Boris can be like elephants on ice on speed when he's out of control. And I speak from personal, because I've been a colleague of his on the Telegraph. He's a clever guy, not very intelligent. That's the point about him. His instinct at some time, as we have discovered, and as I think you're both saying, is really rather poor. I think that the way her mind would work on this, and I think Isabel has given us some pretty good clues, is that foreign policy as generated in the Foreign Office really doesn't matter all that much. And I think that's part of Tory cynicism. I think it's been there for a long time. And she would have been encouraged in her thinking by really an extraordinary maverick civil servant who's been her permanent undersecretary for some time now at the Home Office, Mark Sedwell. Mark Sedwell was successful against all the odds in the Foreign Office, ended up as ambassador to Kabul and then the High Representative, where he shouted down the traditionalists in the Foreign Office. And in his career, he effectively put two fingers up to them. Then he worked in a very tough relationship with May, and she got to respect him, I understand. And I see his dabs all over this one of saying, look here, mum, if you want to survive, you've got the sharks in the shark pool of the Tory party. You've got to pick one. Bring him in. It won't be so bad if he's at the Foreign Office, because the thing I'd like to take further from what you and Isabel have said, I don't think they know what Brexit means. I don't think that they can define it. This is becoming quite apparent on all sides. Now, to leave it to interpretation by David Davis, a really hard over Brexiteer, that's almost a joke. It's almost like setting up to fail, as Isabel said. Now, the arbitration is not going to be done. We've learned this from Cameron. We've learned this from Blair. We've learned it to an extent from Brown. It's not going to be done in the Foreign Office. It's done in the Cabinet Office, and it is done in Number 10. And I want to look very, very closely at who her close advisers are. And I think Mark Sedwell will be somewhere in the mix, even if he stays at the Home Office, where he's very strong on counterterrorism and so on. And the other crucial figure who really is moving, and they're moving on a joint and really quite surprising agenda, is Philip Hammond. And I think Philip Hammond leaving the Foreign Office, this is again part of the clue, say you can handle Boris by parking him there and we'll all keep an eye on him. But for the rest of the country and the standing of the country, there will be a lot of laughter, but there'll be a hell of a lot more tears with Boris.
It's mortifying. Boris's views on the world would have been embarrassing in the 1950s, and he really, you know.
Well, it's hard to know how many of those are his actual views. I mean, he is, as Robert said, a very clever man, right? If not necessarily a great intellectual titan he likes to fancy himself, but his cleverness has also made him a very entertaining columnist.
It's also made him very lazy, by the way.
Indeed. But as a columnist, I think he set himself up principally as an entertainer rather than a serious thinker. And I think a lot of the things he has said for effect rather than because they're what he actually thinks.
No, I don't know that he actually thinks anything consistent at all.
That's entirely possible.
Everything is a jeu d'esprit with him. It's a joke. And the interesting thing is that he always has people behind him who have run things. I suspect that is what happened when he was mayor. It certainly happened when he had the only editorial office of his career when he ran The Spectator. Sorry to be so nitty-gritty about this, but this is the thing. He is where the act has become the person. You know, it's all sort of private school, public school, a little bit of Bertie Wooster, but not as intelligently as deployed by his more intelligent colleague, Matthew D'Ancona, for example. But can we talk about the journalism? I mean, he sees himself as Churchillian in this way. Boris, I think, won't be able to live without his journalism. So what on earth is Theresa May? This is hurdle one that's going to come up very soon. Is she going to make him give up his column in the Daily Telegraph, where he commits so many of his gaffes?
Well, the other rather alarming thing about the job is that he is technically in charge of MI6. Now, MI6 does do some quite serious stuff.
Yeah.
And that is pretty worrying. You know, I mean, if Boris doesn't come to a view of the world and care about British interests in the world, and he has shown absolutely no sign of having any real grasp. You know, he's made a career, you know, on cheap shots at Johnny Foreigner. That is Boris.
I hadn't thought of that, Isabel, and I must say that that's true. Through the Five Eyes, the cooperation, and things like GCHQ, the Americans will not put up with nonsense from Boris. And I think that they'll get him if he's not careful.
Possibly. The other best hope is that he does what he did when he was mayor of London and barely show up in the office and have somebody who knows what they're doing run the place.
Well, mixed reviews then, I think we can say, for Boris Johnson in his first 24 hours in the job. We should move along to Theresa May's in-tray. Now, as a new Prime Minister, she may already have written her so-called letters of last resort. These are the instructions to be carried aboard the UK's nuclear submarines, to be consulted by the captains in the event that Britain has come under nuclear attack. possibly shortly after, or indeed during Boris Johnson's first official visit to Moscow. And one of the first major debates she will need to oversee on Monday is a vote on renewing Britain's nuclear weapons system, Trident. Robert, do you think, this is my own personal conspirazoid view of things.
It's not
even,
like
not even that. I think possibly as a little parting gift, David Cameron scheduled this vote, knowing that the Labour benches are in the complete shambles they are in, knowing this will drive them into even greater shambles.
That's why they did it for the 18th of July. Absolutely right. and I've talked to even the most cynical of Tories and said, this is a political weapon aimed at the heart of the Corbynistas. And poor old Jeremy has been caught because his strongest union backers, namely the Unite Union, have said, we want Trident, quite unusually.
There's because 15, they said,
among our membership, there are 30,000 jobs involved. And that's why I suspect it will get through. I've just written for my paper tomorrow about this. It is the most baffling and difficult and spooky argument. But I'm afraid that Theresa couldn't pull out of this one because she'd been committed to it already. They spent nearly £5 billion on it already.
Just a follow-up point on Trident, though, aside from the political calculations of when the vote is scheduled, it is fabulously expensive, renewing Trident.
More complex than the space program.
Extremely complicated. What does Britain at this point in the 21st century get for it? Is it worth it?
One of the cynical things, of course, and I think it's only a minor consideration, although it's a major political consideration, is the top table. The reason why...
Which you mean the Security Council and so on.
Yeah, Permanent Five. The leadership of NATO. More keen than even the British government that Britain does this is France, curiously, as well as the US. All three, US, France, and Britain now, it has become so complex and so expensive, they can't do it alone. There is intimate sharing with the French to an extent that is not known, I think, generally in the public domain. Most of the day-by-day testing is now being done in France. They are halfway through the new weapon, God help us. And there is lip service to the non-proliferation treaty, but they are going on. And the algebra is looking very, very scary indeed because the world is so nuclear. But how deterrence works in this, I don't really know. They cannot go now because they're beyond a point of no return for a cheaper and more simple weapon. And they just feel it's one of the things that the Brits have to stay in. Unite said 30,000 jobs. I calculate it's about 150,000, 200,000 all told. The submarine business, the shipbuilding, indeed. And I'm completely baffled by this one.
To say nothing, of course, at the extra jobs and or extra expense that may be necessitated, Isabel, by possibly having to move the nuclear submarines from HMB Clyde should Scotland leave the UK.
Indeed. I'm not sure that England has terribly many deep water locks, sea locks available to it to park these things, but they certainly wouldn't be welcome in Scotland. And the way English politics are going, Scotland is looking ever more independent by the day. But this is one of those decisions that is really taken for reasons we never really see. It's a deep state
decision. Absolutely right.
And so it defies, of course, we can make the case, you know, that this is an absolutely obsolete defence concept, you know, post-Cold War. And it's not even to do whether it's nuclear or not. There are very, very convincing arguments that if you want to have nuclear weapons and retain the seat at the top table, this isn't the system. You wouldn't have a like-for-like system. So there were lots and lots of arguments about why this is a really poor deal. I mean, if you had a UKIP bus, for instance, that said, you know, we're spending $16 billion on Trident, wouldn't you like to spend it on the NHS? Of course people would rather spend it on the NHS. Public opinion is not with it. Military thinking, you know, is pretty divided on it. It doesn't have a lot going for it. But everybody knows we can't get out of it, as Robert said.
I mean, Robert, is there a kind of consistent thinking among military folk now about whether this is still a useful thing to have? Or are we in the realm of, you know, the joke about the man sprinkling elephant repellent in Trafalgar Square and someone says there are no elephants in Trafalgar Square and he says, well, it's good stuff, isn't it?
It's not at all. There is such division about this from top to bottom. And it's not only political. There are people, there was Nigel Bagnall would have been head of the armed forces, and he told Margaret Thatcher if she wanted to have credible armed forces, she had to get out of the nuclear arms business, and it cost him his job, more or less. So it's been, it's back to that era. I like, and I've never used the term in this discussion, it is deep state. And it's one of these things that I'm very friendly with people who investigate this and have written very good plays about it, like Richard Norton Taylor of The Guardian. But there are even things that he looks into, that I look into, that Mark Urban, to name another very good investigative journalist, we just don't understand. We don't get into. The first Chief of Defense Materiel, when it was put up to 4-star, a brilliant man called Sam Cowan, said, it is absolutely baffling. You journalists don't stand a chance of tracing the money trail. You know, follow the money, as in Watergate. The votes are all over the place. It's continuing. It is so deep and it's so widely spread. And talking of which, the alternative, by the way, to the Gerloch and Faslane is, wait for it, Milford Haven. Now, Milford Haven, another deep port, possibly they could do it. It's in Wales. And who voted for out? Wales. And who's thinking about having another referendum? Wales. It's just crazy.
It has one other aspect, which is another crazily expensive and useless project, which is Hinkley Point C, the great white elephant of the nuclear power station. And again, when you try and track back that decision to any semblance of logic or sense, you bump up against the need for nuclear engineers. And that is a military need, not a civil need. So there are wider ramifications of this as well.
Very quickly, why this vote on Monday is to build submarines?
Yes.
Because we'll lose the expertise if we don't go through with the main gate contract. It's that kind of thing. And we had a gap in submarine production in the early 1990s, and it cost an awful lot to regenerate it for the Astute class and servicing the current Vanguard and looking forward. And you are, it is one song to the tune of another. You're doing something for very different reasons from those stated on the tin.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Isabel Hilton and Robert Fox. Coming up next, who wants to be Donald Trump's opening act?
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
In times of change, our second film report from the Venice Architecture Biennale focuses on how the National Pavilions responded to curator Alejandra Aravena's quest for new points of view on the social, political, and cultural issues facing the world of architecture today.
We felt as architects, as exhibition makers, but also as members of civil society, and we wanted to become active. So action speaks louder than words. We think nobody can say that we cannot do better. We can. The only question is, do we want to do it better?
You can watch our Venice Architecture Biennale coverage by heading to the film section at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Isabel Hilton and Robert Fox. Now, this time tomorrow, assuming things proceed according to the advertised schedule, we will know the identity of Donald Trump's pick for Vice President of the United States. Pundits and bookmakers alike are offering ever-shortening odds on Indiana government
governor, rather, Mike Pence, but New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and Newt Gingrich, who is still a thing for some reason, are also reckoned to be in the running. Isabel, a question to which there is possibly no short answer. The VP selection is often thought of in terms of balancing a ticket, of compensating for the deficiencies of the top building headliner.
Where would you begin?
Well, indeed. What deficiencies does Trump need to compensate for?
Well, gosh.
We've only got about another 10 minutes. So,
yeah,
you know.
I think words fail me. Seriousness, consistency, policy. I mean, that would start there. He has a lot of voter appeal, rather too much for my taste. But, of course, what he's vulnerable on is, you know, complete inexperience, never held political office.
Isn't his problem, therefore, that if he does put somebody on the ticket who looks like an experienced, plausible, grown-up politician, voters might start thinking, well, hang on.
That's no fun.
Why isn't that guy running for president?
Well, I think given the lineup of possibles, I think we know that they're not going to be hugely popular as possible candidates themselves. I mean, Chris Christie has tried, Gingrich tried, mm-hmm. and who is Pence anyway? So I think that's not a problem. But I think that they're just going to seem like very, very odd bedfellows, because anyone with Trump would seem like odd bedfellows. And I think it would be very difficult for a serious politician, you know, to stand alongside Trump. And it's a bit like, you know, the problem with Boris, you know, that if you're sharing the stage with that character, either you look foolish, you look like, as you say, a warm-up act, and he says such wild and crazy things that you will be associated with. I think it's a pretty tricky role to play, even more so than normally as the Veep.
I mean, is that a problem, I guess, Robert, in terms of the field he has to choose from, that there would be an understanding among serious Republican talent that this is, you're strapping yourself in as co-pilot on a kamikaze mission, aren't you?
Yes, it's a suicide bombing mission, exactly. I think this is very interesting. It's very interesting you drew the analogy with Boris, because what we are seeing with Brexit and with what is going on in the beauty contest of the United States, we are seeing the party system coming under strain. Even the Democrats are, because Hillary is looking like a very, very spotty candidate indeed as time goes on. The past keeps catching up with her. And
you would have to think that almost any other Democratic candidate would be 20 points in front of Trump.
Indeed. And now she's losing ground in the swing states of Ohio and Florida, which is the latest. And that is really serious. And Boris, likewise, points the arrow at the heart of the Conservative and Unionist Party. It's very, very interesting how parties are falling apart. And part of the Brexit argument, which is just not just to go back to that, is not being factored in, is that this does seem to be part of a trend now. Trump, Boris, and populism in Europe. Niall Ferguson tried to argue, though, it's all over, you know, Wilders won't take over in Holland. I tell you, he's gaining ground still. Look what's happening in Italy. The old party systems seem to be breaking up, and it's very interesting to work out why. And that's why you can't rule out Trump, and whoever he chooses may turn out, whoever it is, whether it's Pence, whether it's even Ted Cruz has been mentioned, for goodness sake, that was the latest tweet, you know, may turn out to be very important indeed.
The people who voted, you know, UKIP, Brexit, etc., were basically older, angry white men.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the core constituency, and they're voting an anti-elite vote. Now, Trump has managed to present himself as the anti-establishment candidate. A running mate, you know, if you're going to have a serious politician as a running mate, that's another mismatch. You know, you can't all be insurgents, particularly when you've all got, you know, privileged positions in the elite. It's a tricky message anyway, but it becomes even more tricky if you try to tack policy seriousness onto it.
So just briefly from each of you, who do you think you'll pick?
From what I don't know the states probably as well as either of you, certainly, that it's looking to me as if it will go to somebody like this guy,
Mike Pence,
because actually there's one thing that we get a lot of kicking, but a lot of the journalism has been really quite very good on this and going into things in depth as to, and that's why the Brexit thing is so alarming. Not that the journalism is bad, far from it, But they are so bewildered, the good guys and girls that write about this thing, that it, we are absolutely in deep waters, Holmes, as Watson, wasn't it, as Sherlock Holmes said.
And Isabel, just briefly?
He does seem to be the front runner. I think the one thing you can be sure of is that Trump will get as much publicity out of whatever he chooses as he can. So he's going to keep dropping hints about everybody until the last moment.
Well, if you want publicity, there's always Sarah Palin. But finally, I shouldn't tempt fate. Finally tonight, to the South China Sea, the simmering diplomatic dispute well on its way to becoming a Schleswig-Holstein question for our times, i.e. an intractable and infuriating row which nobody professes to actually understand, bar a few people who are almost certainly bluffing. The latest excitement attending it is the ruling of the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague, which rejected China's claims to substantial quantities of the region. Isabel, does this judgment by the PCA, especially seeing as how China have already said they plan to ignore it, actually make any difference to anything?
Well, it does make it. I mean, I think if it didn't make a difference, you wouldn't have seen China launching this massive diplomatic campaign in advance and then, following up with kind of a lot of warra-warra and huff and puff. So, yes, it makes a difference to China. It makes a difference to China trying to present itself as, the kind of non-threatening, win-win, peaceful rising power, which is looking a little threadbare anyway. It gives courage to the others because, after all, the Philippines is not the only disputant potentially in the South China Sea. Every literal country has the same issue, which is that their exclusive territorial waters are claimed essentially by China through the Nine Dash Line. Mm. So, yes, it does matter. Now, it's also true that no major power has ever accepted an international arbitration ruling that I can find. So the US has ignored them. We've ignored them. So it's routine. But in the end, they are there. And the louder the United States says, we're interested in a rules-based order, rule of law, and all those things, which every country is obliged to pay lip service to if it's not a judgment against them, then it does hang around, and it's awkward for China.
Robert, the Philippines, who were the other party to this dispute, their new president, Rodrigo Duterte, who has not been hitherto known for his cool head, I think it's fair to say, but he's been punctiliously conciliatory about this. He sort of said he wouldn't taunt or flaunt the Philippines' victory. Is he opening... Or is he suggesting that he's open to the possibility of some sort of direct dialogue with Beijing? Yeah.
Yes, and that was in the judgment, by the way, and absolutely right that one of the litigants, it was particularly over one area of the South China Sea that they were exercised, and for understandable reasons, was the Philippines over the Scarborough Shallows, which is where the Chinese have been warning off and warding off Philippine fishing fleet in numbers. And I think people are worried because they think that this is a preliminary to the atolls and so on of China's exploitation of the seabed, and people are getting fed up with this sort of almost mercantilist attitude that the Chinese regimes have had successively to natural resources. This is what has been so difficult to get through to a European and a British audience is that this is vital ground. This is about the most commercially active sea space in the world. Britain is a global maritime power. And when you go back, sorry to Brexit, 40% of Britain's food supplies comes from the EU. We're not going to be able to go on doing that. Where do we go? And a medium power like Britain is locked into discrete arrangements, being a supporter of ASEAN, but also being part of a five-power agreement, because as vital as any one of the principal European allies are allies like Australia and New Zealand now. And this is why, watch this space. It is very serious. It is very important. Across the Indian Ocean and its environs, more than 50% of total maritime global commerce, maritime commerce in the world, will be travelling by 2050.
The fishing is also hugely important. Yes, 30% absolutely. Of fish stocks. And the way the Chinese have been fishing is absolutely monstrous. Apart from destroying the coral reefs, which are the nurseries of all these fish stocks, they've been fishing with cyanide, explosives, absolutely catastrophic.
We will have to leave it there. Isabel Hilton and Robert Fox, thank you both very much for joining us on Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hemena Minyan. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. More music next at 1900. It's Section D, our design show, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.